stations, and from the Gruber Family Foundation for support of NPR's international coverage.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Support for today's broadcast comes from New Prairie Construction. New Prairie Construction features all areas of home construction, from remodeling a kitchen or bath to adding a complete room addition. They also specialize in historic restoration. You can learn more on their website, newprairieconstruction.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. In 1969, a mass murder of Vietnamese civilians came to light. It had taken place in South Vietnam in March of 1968. It came to be known as the My Lai Massacre. It is the best known but not the only atrocity of the war. Today, we'll look into records housed in the National Archives documenting hundreds of atrocities. Our guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Deborah Nelson, author of The War Behind Me, Vietnam Veterans Confront the Truth About U.S. War Crimes, Inside the Army's Secret Archive of Investigations. Deborah Nelson's book, The War Behind Me, is based on declassified Army documents and interviews with suspects, whistleblowers, survivors, former commanders, investigators, and Pentagon officials. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Deborah Nelson, this afternoon. Join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Deborah Nelson teaches journalism in the Philip Merrill College of Journalism at the University of Maryland. Prior to joining the university, she was a reporter and editor for the Los Angeles Times. She also reported for the Washington Post, the Seattle Times, the Chicago Sun-Times, and two small Chicago area dailies. She won the Pulitzer Prize in 1997 for a series of reports exposing widespread problems in the federal government's Indian housing program. You'll find more about her and her book, The War Behind Me, at the website www.thewarbehindme.com. The War Behind Me is published by Basic Books. Again, the phone number is 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Deborah Nelson, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
How did the Army investigation come to your attention?
Well, the archive, which is, as you mentioned, stored at the National Archives and Records Administration, outside of Washington D.C. Where am I today? I actually was in Chicago just this weekend. The entire collection was declassified in 1990, but nobody really knew about its existence until about 2000, when a small number of scholars and journalists discovered it. I mean, if you can picture the last scene of Raiders of the Lost Ark, this incredible collection of records had been stored for a decade at the National Archives, but nobody knew about it because, of course, the Army didn't announce that it had declassified these records after keeping them under wraps for 20 years after the war. Well, one of the scholars that dug into the records in the early 2000s was Nick Terse. He researched them for his dissertation, and after he finished that, he thought that a few of the cases might be newsworthy even this many years afterwards. So he contacted me in 2005. He contacted the LA Times, where I was the Washington investigative editor. His email was forwarded to me. And I have to admit that when I first got it, I was a little bit reluctant to embark on an investigation of a war that occurred back in the 1960s and 70s when we were in the middle of two conflicts that I thought needed more attention in Iraq and Afghanistan. But when I started taking wading into the records, I was so moved by the accounts of soldiers that were in the files and by the information they contained about war and atrocities and history that I was hooked. I thought this is information that the public needs to know, even if it's 30 years late.
Yeah. Now, when you began working this story, the man who was your editor at the time and who had been a war correspondent in Vietnam, it had been his opinion that atrocities were the work of rogue elements in the military. What did your investigation find?
And that was a common view, and one that was promoted by the Army, that, in fact, war crimes weren't a systemic problem, that they were isolated incidents committed by a few rogue units. But Nick and I took the information out of the records, and we entered it into spreadsheets. And when we finished, we discovered that every major division served in Vietnam was represented. Altogether, there were cases involving more than 300 allegations that had been confirmed by Army investigators, but the public hadn't been told. There were another 500 allegations that had not been confirmed. The cases were closed either as unfounded or as closed due to insufficient evidence. And taking a closer look at that, I found that a quarter of those had actually been confirmed but were classified otherwise.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Deborah Nelson, author of The War Behind Me, Vietnam Veterans Confront the Truth About U.S. War Crimes. We have a listener waiting to talk with us already, so let's go and take this call. Listener in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I've been reading recently about both the Philippine insurrection at the turn of the 20th century and the Vietnamese war, and you're bringing up atrocities. One of the points I noted was all in that reading was that there are atrocities on both sides, and certainly in the Philippines insurrection, there was atrocities on the part of the Philippine forces, and this is well documented, etc. So I was wondering if your study just focuses on atrocities by Americans or also gives due to the atrocities by North Vietnamese and Viet Cong against people in the South, people who didn't agree with them, people who they called, quote, collaborators, etc. If you have a balanced or a two-sided view, or if you just focus on the U.S. So I'll get off and listen to you on the air.
All right. He's going to take the answer off the air. So, Deborah Nelson?
This book is based on an archive of records that dealt only with U.S. war crimes against the Vietnamese. There may be a similar body of records in Vietnam. I don't know. That hasn't come to light. This one only came to light in recent years. Certainly, there were war crimes committed by all sides. However, the fact that this archive of records only deals with those committed by us, I think, shouldn't be a reason not to write about it. You know, we have to be accountable for our own actions, and I think it's really important to the records provide a lot of information that I think continues to be extremely important about the conditions that lead to war crimes. The caller mentioned the Philippine insurrection and the Vietnam War, and you know, we have a number of cases in history where counterinsurgency operations led to a high rate of civilian deaths, including atrocities, both accidental deaths, collateral damage, and atrocities. It's the nature of those sorts of wars. You know, you're sending, especially when you're sending foreign forces into a country to fight an enemy that's embedded in a population that's hard to find. And frustrations build, and some members of our troops, you know, whatever the foreign invasion troop is, will take out those frustrations on innocent civilians. And some of the retired generals that I talked to said, you know, that's a good reason to avoid counterinsurgency operations, you know, unless they're absolutely necessary, because they lead to atrocities and sort of a loss of moral standing for our country and those that we've been involved in. And also, from a pragmatic standpoint, it makes it harder to win because you lose the support of the local population that you need.
One of those officials that you talked to, now retired, a very interesting fellow, and we're going to talk about him in a moment. I've got another caller waiting for us, though. His name is retired Brigadier General John Johns, I do believe, if I'm recalling correctly.
Yes.
So we'll talk about him. He's a very fascinating person. You say he was the most intriguing to you in this story in terms of the retired officers that you spoke with. Let's go now and take another call, though. In the meantime, a listener on a cell phone, line 4, hi.
Hi. I was wondering if your research discovered anything about mercenaries that committed atrocities in Vietnam?
No, there was no mention of mercenaries, but that's probably because this body of records dealt only with allegations of atrocities committed by members of the U.S. Army. It doesn't even include Marines or other branches of the military.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Well, now to retired Brigadier General John Johns. Who is he, and why do you find him the most intriguing?
Well, General John Johns, first of all, he was in the 1960s, he was involved in producing research for the Army on counterinsurgency operations. And in doing that research, looking at counterinsurgency operations from World War II on, he came to the conclusion that we should only be involved in Vietnam in an advisory role because it's difficult, if not impossible, to win, and because it's very, very hard to avoid high civilian losses. In the early 1970s, he then was at the Pentagon and on the Army staff. He was among the small group of officers assigned under General Westmoreland, who was then Chief of Army. Army staff. John Johns was part of that group of small officers that was assigned to collect these records and to assess them, to number them, to file them. When they came across his desk at the Pentagon, he wasn't surprised because he had done the research in the 1960s. He wasn't surprised to see that U.S. troops were committing atrocities well beyond My Lai and a few other high-profile cases that, you know, really reached the public consciousness. And so he didn't see, he wasn't surprised, but he felt that the Army now would see that, in fact, there was no good military solution to these sorts of operations. He thought the Army would learn from this. And so after the war, he kept his silence about this, you know, extraordinary archive of records. He kept it until we went to war with Iraq. And when that happened, he completely changed his mind about keeping the records secret. He felt as if now the public needed to know because the Army hadn't kept its part of the bargain. He felt that the Army didn't learn from the mistakes of Vietnam. So what he did was in 2004, this is before I talked to him, in 2004, he contacted the John Kerry campaign. Now, John Kerry in 2004, of course, was running for president and was under attack for testimony he gave back in 1971. He was a young Vietnam vet in 1971, testified before the Senate as a member of the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. He testified that war crimes were a common occurrence in Vietnam. Well, when he was running for office in 2004, the Swift Boat veterans came after him as a liar and called him a liar and fabricator and traitor for his testimony in 1971. John Johns contacted his campaign, called three times to let them know there was this archive of records over at the National Archives that would show that he was telling the truth. But the Kerry campaign never called back.
Mm. I think one of the most fascinating things that you talked with him about was the Pentagon's move away from counting enemy killed to counting bodies. Why the change, and what effect did that have on the conduct of the war?
For a long time, early in the war at least, the Army decided, the military decided to use the number of enemy killed in action as a measure of success. That's how they measured the results of combat action in Vietnam. However, they quickly discovered that commanders in Vietnam were turning in numbers that had to have been inflated. Because, as McNamara said, I think it was 1967, maybe, we would have wiped out the entire population of Vietnam if the numbers were accurate. So he decided that commanders needed to get actual evidence of bodies, that bodies had to be counted, actual bodies had to be counted. It wasn't enough just to turn in numbers, that after a combat action, U.S. forces would be sent out, U.S. troops would be sent out to count bodies of dead enemy. What happened as a result of that was that there was incredible pressure on soldiers now to produce those bodies, to show that they were getting results, that, in fact, we were succeeding in our military operations. It's a haunting letter, a series of letters in the files, from an anonymous soldier. He wrote the first letter to General Westmoreland, then Chief of Staff. He had left Vietnam. He was no longer running the war, but he was Chief of Staff in the Pentagon. He wrote to him in 1970 to alert him to the fact that that civilians were being killed. Something much worse than inflating numbers was happening. The troops were deliberately killing civilians to meet pressures for a higher enemy body count. Now, this letter, to my surprise, really made waves at the highest levels of the Pentagon. The Army Secretary forwarded it to the General Counsel's office for analysis, and the analysis concluded that, in fact, the letter was credible and the writer sincere. So the Army launched an investigation, but not into the allegations of hundreds of civilians being killed deliberately. They launched an investigation into the letter writer to figure out who he was and to try to find him before he could get to the press or to his congressman. It's interesting that, and the file ends with the head of the Criminal Investigation Division letting Westmoreland know that he's, in fact, identified person they think is a letter writer, and they're going out to contact him. And then it just ends. There's no indication of whether they found him or not. And the case is closed without anything being done about the problem.
Yeah.
And, about a year later, after they closed the file, in 1972, Kevin Buckley did one of the rare investigations, independent investigations of civilian killings that we saw in the Vietnam War. He did it for Newsweek. And traveled the same area as the anonymous letter writer had in the Mekong Delta, and visited hospitals, talked to military officials, talked to residents, and concluded that thousands of civilians had been killed deliberately in a major combat offensive that the Army had portrayed to the public as a huge success.
Mm. I want to go back for a moment to retired General John Johns. Here we are, he's voiced opposition to the Iraq War, but here we are in two situations now in Iraq and in Afghanistan where counterinsurgency is a real problem. What does John Johns have to say about atrocities, and can they be prevented in such situations?
He's of the view that they can't be prevented, and that the only solution is to avoid counterinsurgency operations, that that using military force is not it. That the odds are almost insurmountable when you're using military force, that rather than diplomacy and other strategies. And I think we're seeing this in Afghanistan. We're seeing an example of that in Afghanistan right now, where we're relying heavily on airstrikes and on ground actions that have taken a lot of civilian lives. In case after case, we've our military has announced that they've killed a cell of insurgents, only to find that they've hit a wedding party, or many women and children were killed as a result. This created a crisis in Afghanistan for the government that we're supporting, because those sorts of civilian killings turn the population against us and against the government that we're supporting, making it very difficult to win. So, and at this moment, the new administration is trying to decide, what the proper balance is in to tackle the problem of a resurgent Taliban.
This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Deborah Nelson. She's the author of The War Behind Me, Vietnam Veterans Confront the Truth About U.S. War Crimes Inside the Army's Secret Archive of Investigations. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455.
I might point out that John's view is that atrocities aren't preventable, that they will happen. But when I talk to men in combat on the ground in Vietnam, many of them expressed a different view. Most U.S. soldiers who served in Vietnam did not commit atrocities. The records certainly show that it was a systemic problem, that atrocities were a systemic problem, that they were committed by many more troops than we've acknowledged in the past. But most did not do it, and many of the men I talked to were outraged by the atrocities they witnessed and angered that their commanders didn't do more to stop them, and that military leaders didn't change policies and rules of engagement that led to atrocities. And what the records support, the narratives that they provided in their sworn statements, that really show that there was a striking lack of leadership on the ground. Mm. War crimes, atrocities would be committed, there'd be no repercussions. Those who committed them would be allowed to continue in combat. There certainly were very few prosecutions. Very few convictions.
There was a prosecution of a soldier by the name of Roy Baumgartner Jr., although he was found guilty and he went back to serve in Vietnam. Tell us a little bit about what happened there.
Roy Baumgartner was a sergeant in Binh Dinh Province. He served in the 173rd Airborne Brigade, and he led a reconnaissance team out into outside their base to through a rice paddy, and they came across two teenage duck herders and an irrigator. He lined them up, executed them. They were unarmed, executed them on the spot. He then instructed a member of his team to drop a grenade, to detonate a grenade so that their identity would be obscured. And then he dropped weapons around them and reported them as three enemy killed in action. At the time, he was engaged in a body count competition.
Yeah. Well,
in that case, the local villagers were so angered by what happened that they marched to the base and they demanded an investigation. There was an investigation immediately done, and he was court-martialed, convicted of a triple homicide. But his fine, but he was fined a few hundred dollars and busted down in rank, and that was it. No jail sentence. And he was allowed to reenlist and stayed in the Army through most of the rest of the war. Some records that surfaced afterwards showed that he had been accused by another member of his team the year before this happened, before the murders happened, of shooting and killing five other farmers in the field. But it was never officially reported as a war crime allegation or thoroughly investigated, and he continued on until the triple murder occurred and then was allowed to continue after that. I think that, over and again, the records show that, war crimes that were confirmed were not prosecuted. And those that were rarely resulted in convictions, and those that did result in convictions led to very light sentences, which only reinforced the notion that what was known as the Mayor Gook rule, that the Vietnamese were something less than human, and that killing a Vietnamese was not the same as killing a fellow Caucasian.
At the same time, though, and you talked about this a moment ago, it's important to realize that there were soldiers, there were quite a few soldiers who this kind of thing was absolutely abhorrent. And many of the allegations that were brought forward and investigated were brought forward by those who were serving or who had served. And one of these fellows, his name is James Henry. He was a battlefield medic. Tell us about him. His story opens the book.
Yeah, Jamie Henry was part of a company that entered a small hamlet February 8th, 1968 in Quang Nam Province. This is a month before My Lai occurred. On orders from a captain, according to many witnesses, they rounded up 19 civilians, women, children, babies, and opened fire, killed them all. Now, Jamie Henry was the one who reported the massacre. He reported it as soon as he got back to the United States. He didn't report it while he was in Vietnam because there was a belief there that if you made waves, you'd take a bullet in the back. And, people in his company saw that the captain was aware, and, in fact, they heard an order come over the radio to kill anything that moves from the captain, according to the records. And so they felt that there was nobody to, no higher authority to report it to. But he reported it as soon as he got back to the United States while he was still in the Army. The investigator accused him of lying. Unbeknownst to him, the Army eventually opened up a 3.5-year investigation, contacted 100 members of his company, confirmed the massacre as well as a series of murders that occurred leading up to the massacre over several months prior to the time that the company entered this small hamlet. So the Army concluded it happened. They named suspects, but no one was prosecuted, and the findings were never made public. In fact, the first that Jamie Henry learned that an investigation had taken place was when we contacted him in 2005.
Yeah, what was it like for him to read through the documents of the CID investigation that you put before him on the dining room table?
He was surprised and pleased to see that so many men had backed up what he said, had told the truth when contacted by investigators, had told the truth about what happened. He was not surprised to see that the Army had covered it up afterwards.
Another thing that maybe we should talk about in terms of what was going on in Vietnam, why someone like Jamie Henry didn't say anything until he got back home, was you might have had an outright threat against your life for saying anything, right?
That was the belief among many men, and the records the set of records. I haven't investigated to know whether, in fact, there were that whether, in fact, men who reported war crimes did take bullets in the back. But certainly that was the common belief. And very often, you know, the people like Jamie Henry and people in other companies would see members of their fellow members of their company kill Vietnamese, and nothing happened to them. And so you're watching, you know, incredible violence unfold in front of you, and the person who the perpetrator then is, you know, sleeping next to you the next night, and nothing's happened to him. And so that sense that there's no protection is completely understandable.
Yeah. Well, here now, the fellow that comes to mind is a fellow by the name of Robert. Is it Stemmy or Stem, Jr.?
Stemmy, yeah.
Stemmy. He was in intelligence in the Central Highlands of Vietnam, and he saw some really horrific things. And he and others in intelligence there, they formed a pact. And they gave their statements to an officer who was supposed to be on his way back to the U.S. In fact, he was going home, and he was to get these statements to Washington. But that didn't happen, and then the boom was lowered on Stemmy and those who had made these statements.
Yes, in fact, they were threatened with prosecution for making those statements. And it wasn't until a few years later. So the torture continued, you know, water rag, electroshock by telephones, beatings, and it continued. A couple of years later, the Army, while investigating other allegations, came across evidence, this evidence of torture by the military intelligence detachment there, and in fact confirmed that over a 19-month period that detainees were routinely tortured. 20 suspects were identified, 20 U.S. suspects, and there were at least 8 who admitted to using these techniques. Once again, nobody was prosecuted. The findings were kept secret.
I've got a couple of callers who want to talk with you, but before I get to those calls, what impact, not only being in war and witnessing all that goes along with being a soldier, even if you're doing your, you know, your finest, together with that, and then seeing atrocities committed, and then on top of that, seeing that the government isn't going to do anything about it, what kind of toll does that take on a veteran who's come home and trying to put his life back together?
I think that, you know, this drove many, many men into silence. You know, they feared getting criticized by the left and by the right when they came home. It's either, you know, beasts from the left if they talked about war crimes and as traitors from the right. There's a interview in the book, R.D. Miller, who was a radio telephone operator, standing next to the lieutenant who opened fire on in the massacre that Jamie Henry reported. And his experience was, I think, typical of many men who witnessed war crimes and then came home and didn't feel as if they could tell anybody about the horrors of what they saw. He says that when he got home, first of all, when we called him, I left a very general message on his phone. He called back quickly afterward at his wife's urging, he said, and he knew exactly what we wanted to talk about. It's as if he had been waiting for that phone call all his life. And he remembered what happened in such striking detail. I mean, I had his sworn statement in front of me. He hadn't seen it since the day he signed it back in the 1970s. But his memory was crystal clear about even the details. And so we talked about that. And he talked about how, in his words, combat was bad and losing your friends was bad. But, you know, these were innocent people. And he talked about how that had a much more substantial impact on him. And then he continued to have nightmares his whole life. He described that after the war, he became an alcoholic. His marriage fell apart, had a nervous breakdown. He eventually gave up drinking and went into counseling and remarried. But the nightmares continued. And it took him until 2002 to even tell his psychiatrist. The quote I have from him in the book is, I remember when I told my shrink he was speechless.
Mm-hmm.
I told my shrink there's proof of this somewhere. Something like that could never get away without proof.
Let's take some more calls now. Next we go to Mattoon. Listen, you're on line 4. Hello?
Yes. I'm a historian, and I understand that Vietnam is, there was a lot of, as you pointed out, counterinsurgency, and there's a lot of citizens that were innocently killed. I think one of the problems we have is we do not pressure the media to give the full story. And it happens in practically every conflict. And when I teach my history classes, I ask the question, I ask this out in public a lot, how many people died in Vietnam? And everybody, that only 10% probably remember, but when that 10% comes up, they say, oh, somewhere around 50,000. And I said, I didn't ask you how many Americans died, I asked you how many people died. And it tells you that that the media and everybody in general, the figure is somewhere around 2 million Vietnamese to 4 million unofficially. But I see this right now with the Iraqi situation, the Afghanistan situation, is that we never tally up even a rough estimate of how many people have died or maimed or whatever. And this is a continuous process that, if this was to be exposed, I think wars would end quicker, based on the fact that people do not want to hear the bad news, but the bad news is reality, and that's a very simple thing that we could do to perhaps stop. Obviously, if there's 2 million people dead and there's 500,000 Americans that are involved in warfare there at one point in time, that this is something that we really ought to hit upon. And what do you think about this?
Well, you bring up a really interesting point. If you're still on the line, I'd be interested in your take on this. Well, first of all, of course, the military didn't keep tabs on civilian deaths in particular, intentionally did not. But in doing the research for this book, I discovered that there were a lot of stories that ran in the inside pages of newspapers when soldiers would come back and make allegations. They didn't really begin appearing in force until after the My Lai massacre came to light. But then there wasn't an independent investigation of the type that Kevin Buckley did. Often it was just story reporting that these allegations were made, and, of course, the Army's or the military's response to that. But I guess I was surprised at how many appeared and how few remained in the public consciousness, this many years after the war. People remember the My Lai massacre. They might remember a few other atrocities, but it seems that the memory of the other allegations that soldiers spoke about publicly back then and that appeared in the press have been forgotten. And I wonder if it is, and I don't have an answer to this, I wonder if it's because, first of all, as a journalist, I know it's really hard to get readers to interest them in reading about the plight of racial others in a faraway place. And so when people read about the Vietnam War, were they reading closely the stories that about U.S. deaths in Vietnam? And so, of course, that remains burned into our memory, the bodies coming back. And did they just forget the ones about the Vietnamese being killed? Did they not believe them? Did they not read them? I don't have an answer to that question. I did see that the media covered it. I don't believe that the media has done enough independent investigation. They didn't do it then, and they didn't do it. They haven't done it now. Most of the independent investigation into civilian deaths has been done by the alternative media, by The Nation, Salon.com, Mark Benjamin there, and a handful of others.
Okay, well, let's get the listener in Mattoon to respond, and then I've got a couple of other calls. So, listener in Mattoon, go ahead.
The fact is that it's a very simple mathematical situation to any news media or authors to keep a running tally of even a rough estimate of the deaths in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we do hear that so many people were killed, and it's an isolated figure, but nobody keeps a running tally. Now, we see a running tally constantly on Americans that are killed, and even Europeans that are killed. But this is a gross mistake if we do not report the news as accurately as we can, or as historians don't do it on a continued basis. Now, and you're absolutely right. The media, the Army, I don't think are trustworthy, because if they were, they would be giving out some estimates on that. And this would cut down, or this would put more analysis on what the war and what we're doing and whether or not we should be continuing doing it.
Thank you. Okay. Thanks for the call. How difficult is it for journalists to get their hands on, to get a sense of, and there have been some organizations, some not-for-profit organizations, some non-governmental organizations that have tried to do this, but it seems difficult or challenging, but this doesn't mean it shouldn't be done, to get a handle on civilian deaths.
There and you know, the reports from various organizations have varied widely
right.
in their numbers, but I think the caller was right. That doesn't absolve us. I don't think it's quite as simple as he said. However, we could make more of an effort to determine those numbers and provide a range at the very least to give a sense. But I guess my focus has been on going behind the numbers and really determining, first of all, you know, whether some of those killings are deliberate, and you know how many are collateral damage. I think that sort of information is really important to know what policies aren't working and what rules of engagement are leading to excessive civilian deaths. So we're not seeing evidence that the military is doing it, and I don't see evidence that the press is doing it to any great extent either.
Okay, let's see if we can get these two calls in. Listener on line one in Champaign, hi.
Hi. I guess my comment our question to your guest is, in your canvassing and research for your book, did you encounter soldiers who encountered the enemy in villages that were using the civilians in those villages for cover? And what a dilemma for a soldier, it seems to me. I mean, do you have any of those kinds of stories?
Oh, yes, absolutely. In fact, there are a number of those stories in the book. And Robert Gard, who is retired lieutenant general, talks about his personal experience with a hamlet where, they were taking mortar from a hamlet, which they knew was filled with civilians, and it blew out half of his trailer. He had just gone to bed one night, and, where he'd just been sitting was blown out. Well, he got pressure from above. He was an artillery commander. He got pressure from above to respond with artillery, to wipe out the hostile force in that hamlet. And he said, the hamlet's filled with civilians. We can't do that. And the 9th Division commander swore at him and said, I want you to wipe them out. They're attacking us. Well, he didn't. Guard didn't wipe them out with artillery. He sent in a force on the ground to in a very strategic, suture-like manner to just go in and take out the mortar. And they did. And that's exactly what they did. And that solved the problem. So there was always, I think, that goes back to what John says about, about the problem with counterinsurgencies. The enemy is embedded with the civilian population, making it very difficult to fight them. The answer isn't to kill civilians in order to kill the enemy, because then you lose the support of the civilian population, and you need the support of the civilian population in a situation like that in order to win.
Mm. I want to thank the listener for his call. I've got another caller. We're just here at the edge of time. I'm afraid we won't be able to take that call this afternoon. Here to wrap up, what would you like to say in terms of maybe you want to offer us a thought about why it's important to set the record straight or what we should do with this information? What are your thoughts here? What do you think you would like to talk about as a way to sum up, to wrap up?
I think from a very practical standpoint, there are lessons to be learned from these records about the conditions and policies that lead to atrocities. We shouldn't be repeating our mistakes. Body count was something that led to civilian killings in Vietnam, and yet it reappeared in the first years of Iraq. That's something we should have learned. Indiscriminate firing on civilian areas led to high civilian deaths. We're seeing that again in Afghanistan. But I think most important, there's a columnist at the Chicago Reader in Michael Miner, who in reviewing the book said, when will this become part of what we all understand about war? And I guess that's my hope, is that, people will read this and it will become part of what they understand about war.
There, we have to leave it. Deborah Nelson, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Well, thank you.
Deborah Nelson is the author of The War Behind Me, Vietnam Veterans Confront the Truth About U.S. War Crimes Inside the Army's Secret Archive of Investigations. The publisher is Basic Books. More about our guest and the book at the website www.thewarbehindme.com. It's 1:54. Let's go to Todd Gleason now, who has settlement prices for us. Todd? Okay, let's try again. Here's Todd Gleason. Todd?
Very much, Celeste. Let's take a look at those numbers in Chicago as they finished up on a Tuesday afternoon. Futures in the wheat pit were lower for the day. The March contract settled on this Tuesday afternoon, down 9 cents at $5.56, the high 566, low at 543.5. Settlement price for that March contract, once again, 9 lower at $5.56. May futures, 578.75, the high, the low at 56.5. Settlement price at 569, down 9. And July, the harvest month for the soft red in Chicago, 591.25, the high, the low at 69. Settlement price at 581.5, down 9 cents. September futures 8.25 lower at 607. The high 613.5. The low at $5.94. From the hard red winter wheat pit in Chicago, or in Kansas City rather, $5.89 was settlement price there for the nearby March, down 6 cents. The May down 6.25 at 599.75. Corn pit now, nearby March contract 380. The high, the low at 68. Settlement price 376.75, down 3/4. The May 390 on the high. The low at 78.25. Settlement price at 387, down a penny. July futures $4.50, the high, the low at 89. Settled at 397 and a quarter, down 1 1/4. And September futures 410.5, the high, the low at 99.5. Settled at 407.5, down a penny and a quarter for the day. December futures 424, the high, the low at 12.75. Settlement price at 420.5, down 1 1/4 for the new crop December corn. And the March 2010, 434.25, down a penny and a quarter, too. March contract in the oat pit today, 194.5. Settlement price, penny and a half lower. May futures down 1 cent at 204. From the soy complex, March beans, 1010, the high, the low at 982. Settled $9.94, down 8. The May futures, 1015.75 on the high. Low at 988.75, settlement price at $10.25, down 7.25. July contract, 1022.75, the high, the low at 995.75, settlement price at $10.07.25, down 7.25. And the August soybean, 6 cents lower, 1008.25, the high, the low at 987.5, settlement price at $9.98. September futures, a 967 settlement price, down 7. And the November beans, 950 on the new crop high, the low at 929.75, settlement price at 939, down 4 cents. March bean meal at 312.10, down 170. And the March bean oil at 33.64, down 59 for the day. I'll return in just about 10 minutes this afternoon. We'll talk with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities out of New Market, Indiana. And we'll hear from Daryl Good, Extension Ag Economist, about this morning's USDA reports. That all happens at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Kathy Ferguson in Morris at 815-941-3758. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Let's take a look now at livestock contracts and how they finished the trading day. February live cattle, 85.45 the high, 84.50 the low, 84.77.5 the settlement, that up 7.5. April, 88.90 the high, 87.80 the low, 88.05 the settlement, that up 30. June, 86 even the high, 85.15 the low, 85.40 the settlement, that up 47.5. August, 86.35 the high, 85.55 the low, the settlement 86.20, that up 47.5. March feeder cattle, 96.90 the high, 95.60 the low, 95.70 the settlement, that up 15. April, 98.20 the high, 96.95 the low, the settlement 97.10, that down 25. May, 99.30 the high, 98.32.5 the low, the settlement 98.47.5, down a nickel. August, 101.30 the high, $100.30 the low, the settlement $100.47.5, that down 2.5. Lean hogs finished higher on the day. February, 57.15 the high, 56.45 the low, the settlement 56.75, that up 70. April, 62.75 the high, 61.70 the low, the settlement 62.30, that up 2.22.5. May, 74.45 the high, 73.45 the low, the settlement 74.40, that up 185. And June lean hogs, 75.40 the high, 74.45 the low, the settlement 75.05, that up $2. February pork bellies, 80.02.5 the high, 77.90 the low, the settlement 78 even, that up 97.5. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 378 points at 78.93. The NASDAQ is off 65 at 15.27. The S&P 500 down 42 at 8.28. Oil down 169 at 37.87. 1 minute before 2 o'clock, this is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. We're going to make way for the closing market report, which follows the news from NPR. Our technical director this afternoon is Henry Frain, and the producer for the Afternoon Magazine is Harriet Williamson. My name is Celeste Quinn. Let's take a quick look at the weather forecast first for the WILL severe weather coverage area. A flood watch for Champaign, Christian, Clark, Coles, Cumberland, DeWitt, Douglas, Edgar, Ford, Iroquois, Livingston, Logan, Macon, McLean, Moultrie,